Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Phileas Club. Do you know what this show is? Well, first of all, it's supported by Patreon. So if you like the show and you're not already a patron at patreon.com/thePhileas Club, which you should be, if you can, that would be awesome. Then go to patreon.com/thePhileas Club and consider becoming a patron. And if you don't know how to type that URL, you can go to the show notes and it's right there waiting for you. So that's the first thing. The second thing is what the show exactly is. We get people from different countries, different cultures, different backgrounds, and we get together and we talk about the state of the world and how we see it with our different eyes, I guess. However, it's not what we're doing today, because every other show we do a special where we talk about one specific topic, one specific place, one specific culture. And today it's a specific issue, I guess, which Wendy Dunford is going to help me explore. Hello, Wendy. How's it going?
Hi. Good. Thank you for having me.
I'm always so happy when you're here because you're so much smarter than me that letting you speak elevates my perceived intelligence. So that is positive
nice.
For me.
I'll do my best.
So I said you're going to help me explore a topic, but really you're the professional and the expert, and I don't know anything about it. So you're really going to explain to me, and we're going to talk about toxic relationships. That's not the type of discussions we usually have. I think usually we try to talk about a country or a religion or a political movement, these kinds of things. But for some reason, I thought, you know, I've been thinking about this topic for ever since Trump was elected. because you said something about that, and we're not going to talk about that, but it had to do with toxic relationships. And I thought that was a topic we should explore further, and it stuck with me. And 3 years later, and a kid an extra kid in the world.
Yeah. Your life has changed.
Yeah. And you know what? Maybe it has to do with that. Maybe I feel the first year of my relationship with this child was somewhat toxic. It took.
Actually.
Yeah. Thank God it's cute.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
So I guess, first of all, can you introduce yourself? I know most listeners of this show, most regular listeners probably know who you are and what you do. But for those who might not, can you tell us a little bit of your background?
Yes. So my name is Wendy Dunford. I live in the United States of America now. I was in Sweden, which made me much more interesting. And now I'm back to being boring. And I am a licensed clinical social worker. And there's lots of different psychotherapist terms, right? And I'm a psychotherapist and I work with couples and families and adolescence is as young as I'll get because I have children. I don't want to talk to more children. but now I have teenagers, so I don't want to talk to them either. So mainly adults at this point. And I've been doing this for 20 years. My connection to you is through my brother who needs a bunch of psychoanalysis. And so I help him out on Thursdays on his morning show, Therapy Thursday. So that's been my connection to you. And so, yeah, and I you can find me online in a couple different places and we can talk about that. But, you know, one of my main focuses ultimately in doing this, first of all, it's very uncomfortable for me. It's gotten better. I love that you've had me on to talk about politics because I could do that all day long for fun and not feel like I have to know too much. And that's nice. Whereas this stuff is a little trickier because it is it comes so naturally because this is what I do and I know a lot about it. But it is so private, right? It's, you know, my whole occupation and my industry, you know, confidentiality is so crucial to what we do. And so to talk about it openly, I find very strange sometimes. I've gotten used to it over the years, but because it is so private. And this topic in particular really hits at the core of each of us. So when you have these discussions with your people all around the world about politics and religion and, you know, sort of things outside of their homes, you know, that stuff matters and it's amazing and interesting and often scary or whatever. But everything starts at home. And so I feel like we get to the core of that. And it's a challenge for everyone everywhere, regardless of culture. There's nuances, of course, but it's a powerful place to start. So anyway, I'm fascinated by this as well.
I think this is actually, we're going to get into it. Don't worry. Yeah. But there's something really interesting in what you're saying there, because talking about politics and religion, which are perceived difficult topics, I think on this show, maybe more so than on other venues, we managed to talk about it in a relatively relaxed and comfortable way. But so it's not like it's perceived difficult, but I think it's not that uncomfortable. But when we start talking about topics like these, like toxic relationships or more intimate stuff, that's where the actual uncomfortableness steps in. Even if you're not directly involved in anything like that, it becomes a little bit like, how should I react? What should I say? Like, it's much more, obviously, it's much more personal for everyone involved. So maybe we can start by defining, I think we all know more or less, we have an idea of what a toxic relationship is, but maybe you can tell us more precisely what that is technically.
Yeah, and we can go into sort of some directions and you can guide me because it's literally a bottomless pit that we could address. But a toxic relationship, as a general rule, if you think about anything toxic, right, it's poisonous. It's typically slowly poisonous, right? You know, you're not going to just eat a giant block of a heavy metal and die immediately. You're going to slowly accumulate heavy metals through your drinking water or whatever. So that toxicity is a slow moving thing. And that's true in relationships. So often you meet someone, you date someone, you're falling in love with someone, you're pretty blind to everything. And it's sort of meant to be that way. It's what helps us, you know, as a species, propagate the species. We wouldn't otherwise, if we had full vision of how weird this person was, it probably would never work, right? So this blindness is pretty powerful and valuable, but it lasts about, in most relationships, it lasts about 3 to 18 months of just sort of the bliss honeymoon phase, right?
So just enough to have a lot of sex and make sure you make babies if you're exactly in the wild. Yeah, okay.
Exactly, because there's no point after that, right? Yeah. So then it's when that sort of dies away, it's when, you know, sort of him squeezing the toothpaste from the middle starts to make you feel insane, or, you know, that type of stuff starts to come along, and in-law troubles and all the things sort of show up, and no longer does it feel like you can conquer the world and love is all you need. And so then you have to access a bunch of different skills and make a relationship work. And then you add the actual human, as you know, and that is a whole nother playing field of how do we stay connected and together when we have this little monster trying to tear us apart, right? So that is tricky. And so the, you know, normal, challenging, everyone's sort of dealing with these types of things. What happens with toxic relationships is there's elements that get introduced. Sometimes they're there on the first date and they're obvious. You just don't see them. Often they sort of creep in because, you know, you think about an abuser. If someone in an abusive relationship met that person today, they wouldn't date them. They wouldn't marry them because it doesn't start there. It starts with sort of slow, typically emotional types of things, psychological types of things. Eventually you can get to the physical violence. And today I'm going to steer pretty clear of the physical violence because it's actually not as harmful as these other things. And 99% of physical violence includes all these other things we're going to talk about, the emotional and psychological stuff. So it's slow. It comes on. And when you start to see and notice some things going wrong in a relationship, here's where the relationship itself becomes toxic, is the partner who is being abused or mistreated starts to behave in certain ways that to protect themselves and or to denial or to keep things going, that create a cycle where now this toxicity is back and forth between the two people. And so we can get into more specifics.
So wait a second, do you mean back and forth, the relationship becomes toxic for both people, or it's...
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting. Yes. Because the way I imagine toxic relationships, there's the abuser and the abusee, the abused person. I'm guessing that's still the archetype, but it's toxic for both.
Well, and let's maybe define this a little separately. There's abusive relationships where it really is like you're saying. This is what most people think of, right? There is the one abuser trying to control and manipulate the victim. And yes, that is. But this is more generalized as toxic relationships goes. I've seen this many times in my practice, and you've seen it in the popular media too, where there are two people who are abusive to one another. There is a sort of a cyclical dance that they do. I'm trying to think of maybe a famous one we all know of.
But I see what you mean. It's certainly something that we can, I'm sure we all have either in our own history or in our surroundings, a couple that we think, you know, those two, they might even be in love, but they're just not good for one another. And it's difficult for both. Actually, let me ask you this before we continue. Are toxic relationships... I'm guessing no, but are they exclusively romantic relationships, or can it be, parent and children, or I don't know, other type like work relationships? I don't know, any kind of relationship, or is it like predominantly? Yes, it can be anything.
Absolutely, it can be any place. I mean, the romantic relationships we have the most sort of expertise on and data on, and we know more how to handle those because we're already working with marriages and partnerships that, you know, have challenges and just have your normal flaws or hiccups or communication problems, right? Plus, we've got the whole arena of where it is abusive. So we've spent a lot of energy and time on romantic relationships. But this type of behavior, of course, can exist everywhere. So the parent-child one is another one we have well documented because that's often where some of this begins. So I'm going to start with how this sort of ever happens, right?
Probably going to get into this, but I do have a question that might tell me if you're going to get to it. But we didn't quite define when a relationship goes from, you know, it's just annoying because they eat cereal, you know, from the from the box.
Right.
To actual toxic, like, because I'm sure everyone knows people who annoy one another and who are a little bit annoying, but that's a different step. So if you're gonna get to it, just, you know,
I will. In fact, let's just talk about a little bit of what would be included in a toxic relationship. And there's degrees of toxicity, so maybe that's a helpful way to think of it as grades of this, right? So you could have a boss who just sort of backhand compliments you, like, wow, you did a really good job on this, better than last time, you know, like there's always like a dig or a something, right? That no one wants to be around that doesn't feel good, but you're now wanting to please that person a little more, or you start to feel a little trapped. I mean, you can have these in smaller doses in various relationships, so we can go from that with a boss that you just think, well, I'm gonna get a new job, he's annoying, and that can get more and more toxic the longer you stay, et cetera, all the way to you've been married for a good amount of time and this person is gaslighting you, which we'll talk about gaslighting at some point, so don't worry, I'll define that term, or physically abusive or psychologically, you know, abusive. So it runs the gamut and it can be kind of all over the place. So let's talk about
what
ingredients.
And when you have those low levels, you say, you know, over time it becomes worse. Even if the levels don't increase, kind of, it weighs on you, I'm guessing, in a way that makes it even as something that, you know, if someone witnesses this, it's like, oh, you know, he's an ass, but you're not going to lose sleep over it. But if you've been right. into that, receiving that kind of, you know, even minor, quote unquote, abuse for 3 years, maybe it becomes an actual, like a genuine problem that affects you. That's what you mean? Okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, as people listen to this, what if they're not in a toxic romantic relationship, they'll think, well, this doesn't apply to me. But as we talk, you'll start to notice, oh, I had a boss like that. Oh, that friend from high school. Oh yeah, she did those things. Or even an old relationship that you eventually got out of, and now you're a little more clear-headed about it. You can say, oh yeah, there were some things in there that weren't great. So I want everyone to write on your piece of paper. I'm sure you're all taking notes. Power. So power is very central to all of this. So every relationship, there is a power differential and dynamic that's happening, right? So a couple who's a little more equal in their power, they're both really into the other one. They both feel, you know, like their lives are going good, and they share the chores and the daycare, and, you know, like things feel pretty equal in power. And we would call that, you know, a pretty healthy, balanced relationship. Whew. Now, navigating
nice.
That
I felt you were easy. You were describing my wife and me, and I was like, but actually, I was waiting for the other shoe to drop.
No, okay, I'm calling right, it healthy. Cool. That's healthy and normal. Like, it shouldn't be perfect by any shot.
Of course.
But there's navigating, and developmentally, the relationship changes, and then you add kids, and they change. And so it's some flexibility and sharing power, right? Mm. And so when we get to any toxic relationship, you got to ask yourself what's happening with the power. So let's stick with the boss employee power dynamic for a second. And this is often where women in the workforce have a particular challenge when it's, you know how I love to make fun of white dudes. So white dudes with power and that power dynamic that they're just used to, they think it's like air, it's automatically theirs, how that runs into some challenges with an employee who threatens that power or an employee
just to expand just a tiny bit on this. When you say it feels like, you know, it's just like air, the way I understand it, maybe you can tell me if that's what you mean. They don't feel it's a power dynamic. It's just how things work without, you know, and I wonder if sometimes, I guess sometimes it feels bad when you're being told there is this, type of power dynamic that is inherent to our society, because you don't feel it's a power dynamic. That's just how things are. Right. Okay. All right.
Yeah, absolutely. You're entirely exactly right. And so you take, and this is where, I mean, we're using non-romantic for a second. We'll get to what that looks like, but is suddenly there is a threat to your power. And whatever that, you know, before it was just a given, I have the power. And now I have to hire a woman and a person of color, and I'm told I'm the bad guy. I mean, a shift in how everyone's seeing this is a threat to that power.
Yeah, I think I have to hire a woman or a person of color. It feels like most people wouldn't have a problem with this. Like, maybe the argument like, oh, I want to hire the best person for the job, not the person who's that or that. I understand that part, but I'm told I'm the bad guy. I completely understand that it feels bad, right? It's like, I didn't do anything. Like, I'm just here. And okay.
Right. Right. And there's those who just see this, you know, that don't have a problem with this at all, because the power, they don't have a need for the power, right? Mm. They have a need to lead, and they have a need to, you know, do what's right by the company or whatever the dynamic might be. There's lots of good versions of people doing this, but this version in particular. Mm-hmm. So you take, let's just say there's a guy named Jim, and that's how he's feeling. He's feeling like he's losing his power. Who knows what's going on at home? He goes to work, and there's somebody that just triggers that feeling of maybe it's insecurity or something gets triggered, and you need to show your power. Now, back in the day, maybe you just fire someone or you throw something. I don't know what you could do back in the day. Smoke in your office, whatever. But now, what can you do? And there, it's sort of this sort of subtle, but it's behavioral activities that eventually make sure you have your power and lowers the other person's power. So for example, so there's a couple categories here, and this applies to all relationships, but we're going to stick with the boss for a second. So humiliation, negating, or criticizing. So if you think about human beings, we need to know we're okay. We need to know that we're liked. We need to know that we're safe, those kinds of things, right? So it's very fundamental to being a human. And so there is a huge taking of power when we call someone a name, or there's even subtle forms of that, calling someone a pet name, like a derogatory, hinting, you know, little joke, you know?
Like what? Telling, can you give an example?
Maybe here's a dumb one that I read when I was getting ready for this, but just like, you're my little knuckle dragger or my chubby pumpkin, like some kind of, it's supposed to be cute. It's supposed to be in theory. And so the receiver is insulted and complimented at the same time. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's like a, and well, it starts to mess
with people. I got a compliment.
People.
They paid attention to me, but at the same time, it's not the best version of what that could be. And it makes you feel a little weird or worse.
Right. And so, and I'm going to get to how we know. I will tell you the ways to know that this is happening to you. But usually it's that you feel off, wrong. Like what? Ugh, that didn't. And now the power is your boss just called you a kind of rude pet name, but you're confused. So, what do you do with it?
So what if, I'm coming at this from the angle of the dumb person, as always, but what if the boss calls you something, you know, cute, genuinely wanting to be, you know, to do something adorable, and the person on the receiving end doesn't feel bad about it? It's like, oh, you know, it's cute, it's fun. Is that okay? I mean, maybe that's not in the scope of toxic relationships. It might be not okay in other ways, but if you're okay with being called that, then it's fine, right?
Right. And here's the thing. How do you both know you're okay with it? You'll have to explicitly say, I like that nickname. Feel free to call me that. And the boss is like, okay, great. No power change here. We're fine. You know, I mean, that's the problem is that there is incentive for the one with less fat power to fake that everything's fine, right? Because they don't actually have the power. And it's easy for the person with the power to take just forget that they have the power. Mm. And that them calling someone a pet name, which you would do to a child, is inherently a little derogatory. Now, you can say, oh, people are having fun. Well, if everyone agrees you're having fun, cool, you're having fun. But just the naming of something
the nature of the relationship makes it difficult to be sure that everyone's having fun, I guess.
Well, and this is where, you know, when people love to throw out reverse racism, right? That's that's not a thing. It's not a thing when you're not the group being who has been systematically discriminated against. You can't, because of power. Right.
That's often when some people talk about reverse racism, what I like to say is like a person, like a black person, can be racist towards a white person or say something that is racist, but that doesn't make the system racist towards that group. The racism is about the minority being treated in a different way. So, yeah. Right.
Right. And so that's kind of the bigger picture of the power differential. Right. And so that's the key here. If you are a boss to anyone, it's a very lonely place to be in the end, because even just, you know, what you're attempting to make is fun camaraderie is still a power differential that can get you in trouble, and make the other people feel pretty crappy. So we take that from like a low level thing. Obviously there's very toxic, awful workplaces that this is much more serious, but we'll say there's sort of this innocent version of this, right? But again, going back to our categories of humiliation, negating, criticizing, those are things of like joking, right? In quotes, joking or sarcasm, insults about someone's appearance, belittling an accomplishment, you know, pushing someone's buttons. There's so many versions of this thing, and yelling and swearing at someone, calling them names. I mean, there's all the things you can think of that are to put a person down and keep the power the way that person wants the power to be. And then it leads us to a little more intense types of things like control and shame. So all of us have a sense of some control over our lives or elements of our lives. And we also take that for granted until it's sort of challenged or taken away, right? And there is and you may know this as a father, but your kid is so young, you're not maybe in the thick of this yet. But if you want to control a child, it's incredibly easy. You just shame them. Mm. You make them feel bad for the thing that they did. You make sure they know you have the power at all times, and that kid will behave. Because he wants so badly for you to love him that he will do the things if you use shame. Now, I have a full-time job because that's how people have been raised. Mm-hmm. So please, no, please don't do this. but it really is, it's really like the easiest form of control.
What's the dynamic that this creates for the kid emotionally down the line?
Right. And here, that is an awesome question that leads to why we have adults continuing or that have toxic relationships is when you're a kid, if you're experiencing any kind of emotional, psychological abuse, you're experiencing lots of shame, parents who have high control needs. And what most kids do is they comply until their brain develops enough to the point where they realize they got to get out of there. So they'll rebel, they'll escape, they'll run away, you know, they'll do that. Or that can be one, like the real kid in there kind of breaks free at some point, or they comply. And then they move on in their lives and they seek out people who are controlling because they're very used to that feeling. And this is where we have sort of cyclical generational abuse that sort of goes into the, everyone says, I will never be like my father or my brother or my dad or whatever, or my mom. And then they find themselves married to someone who has similar types of things. And you're thinking, what, I how can I be here? And some of it is we're just used to it, right? So if you're used to, and people will have this in a workplace, they will have worked somewhere. They kind of know it's toxic. People are telling them like, are you sure you want to work there? And then you change jobs and you cannot believe the cloud used to look.
Oh my God. I've seen this more than once.
Right. Yeah. Right.
It's similar in
relationships. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
I just, about what you were saying, it reminds me of this quote from a wonderful movie called The Perks of Being a Wallflower, where at some point, for a specific reason, one of the characters tells the other, we accept the love we think we deserve. Mm-hmm. And that hit me like a ton of bricks. It was so revelatory as a concept. And I think about it every month at least once, and it's such a beautiful thing. But
No, and that is a perfect summation of what this is mm-hmm. that if you were used to feeling only that you were only good enough if you were behaving just like they wanted you to, or you know, and that kind of control, and then if you didn't, then you were a shame and the worst, and they can, you know, it feels like love. Now, when you're a kid, it's love or you don't love. It doesn't get complicated for them. It's either I'm good enough and I'm loved or I'm not. Mm. And so this is why it's so dangerous when this is happening to children. And then when they grow up to be an adult, they have the same skill set. And like you said, like they can only feel as much love as they believe they're allowed to have. Mm-hmm. And so someone could come along and love them and would be healing and amazing and this wonderful, but they can't actually get there because the belief about themselves has been pretty hijacked as children. So this is sort of how it can happen. Now, of course, there are the cases where you have this lovely childhood, not controlling parents, it's all good. And then you find yourself madly in love with someone and it's usually fast and furious at the beginning and, you know, risky and all of the things, and it's amazing, and your brain's kind of damaged from all of that. And then some of the signs start to show up of the abuse, and you don't know what hit you. And this was not my childhood. Why am I here? And so obviously there's other cases like that too, but very commonly there's a level of familiarity with the feeling. Maybe your parents were controlling or a little abusive, and so you don't quite see it. It's like the fish or the crab being boiled in hot water, right?
The toad, the frog.
The toad, yeah. The frog, that's what it is. That's right. Okay, go ahead.
No, go ahead, keep going.
I was just going to continue a little bit with what to pay attention to with control and shame. Just some of the techniques that abusers use and can be part of toxic relationships is threats. So this is, again, trying to maintain power. So you threaten, I will divorce you. I'll take the kids and disappear. I'll commit suicide if you leave me. I mean, there's all sorts of ways that threats just freeze the person, of course, right? They don't want you to take the kids. They don't want you to kill yourself. So they're powerless and they stay, kind of thing. Mm. Monitoring your whereabouts, following, you know, making sure they know where you are at all times, spying on all your devices, sort of.
Jealousy. I have a big problem with jealousy. Like even mild, mundane jealousy, I find, I don't know, kind of repulsive. But that might say more about me than it does about others. But is that also a sign of something?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And over jealousy. Like there's going to be things like, oh, you were talking to that beautiful lady and I'm feeling a little jealous. And you could talk about it and there would be like, oh, you have to worry, whatever. So normal, right? Jealousy is a normal human response to a feeling of threat. Now, if it's extreme and you're jealous about everything, that is obviously a problem. And one way that sort of shows up is controlling of friends and family and contact. So another sign of that you're in an emotionally and psychologically abusive relationship is if your partner shrinks and shrinks and shrinks your social circle. I don't like those friends, or you shouldn't go out with her, and starts to make sure everyone's an enemy, including family and friends and all the people that love you. And so the more isolated you get, the more you need them, the more they have power.
The more you talk, the more I'm realizing things that I somewhat knew already, but I can put names on relationships that were different levels of toxic and not necessarily, you know, world ending and not all romantic relationships, but I've certainly experienced instances of, you know, friends or other relationships that were kind of forcing these kinds of things in order to assert their power because they. And I'm a little bit older now, so maybe I see it a little bit more. But back then, I mean, it's super clear that was the issue, including the childhood traumas and all of that. So,
And everyone, and I should have made a caveat at the beginning here. Some of this will trigger people. So I apologize.
I'm going to title the episode Toxic Relationships. So hopefully that will be clear.
Okay, so they know. Because it really is, and often we live in a space of sort of denial generally, right? Like we all get in our cars and drive, you know, 100 miles per hour on the freeway and are like, we should be terrified of that. But we have just gotten used to stuff. We're kind of in a trance of like, we're fine until things come along and wake us up out of that. And so sometimes hearing somebody talking about these dynamics, you go, oh, I'm in trouble. And you didn't know until you hear it. And so that's why we always have to do, you know, trigger warnings, because triggering is popping someone's denial bubble a little bit and just showing them, wow, there's some things actually happening here. And so, you know, if you go online and just Google like signs of a toxic relationship or signs of, you are going to read all this and list all of these things. There's quizzes to take. There's all sorts of things. If you are suspicious and don't know quite what to do, start there. And then I'll get into what to actually do. And then I'm also going to get into how do we help someone we know who's in a troublesome relationship.
Yeah, I think that's a super important thing because, I mean, we'll get to it then. But obviously, when you witness this, you feel powerless to help because it feels like nothing you do reaches that person.
Yes. And there are ways to reach them. Our natural inclinations are the worst things to do. And so you have to really control what you naturally want to do, which is usually rescue and like kidnap them and hide them. And, you know, you have to resist that stuff. And there's much better ways. So we will get to that. But I did want to throw out a couple more triggers for people. Mm-hmm. So lecturing, right? Long monologues about how you're wrong. Direct orders, treating the other person like a child, telling them what to wear, what to eat. You don't like this about their body, you know, creating a sense of I have the power and you need me to be okay. And the way to keep that power is I'm going to point out your flaws. I'm going to hang up on you. I'm going to walk out, embarrass you, you know, just behaviors that essentially make you now focused on that person and keeping them happy, because the results would be that you're going to lose something. You're not good enough. You know, so you start to build this. Now you think, oh, we just went on a date and we really liked each other. How do I get to this point? Well, these things show up slowly usually. And they usually come one at a time. And usually the first time people are a little bit like, oh, did you just hang up on me? Like you're a 7-year-old. And then what do you do in that moment? Often if it depends on your skill set. If your skill set is, okay, well, I'll ignore that. I'll talk myself out of that. It was weird.
I guess it's easy to think, you know, that was weird, but it's not like, you know, they didn't murder someone. They just hung up.
Right.
It's frustrating,
right.
But, and then they right. will apologize. And I mean, obviously I don't think you should end a relationship anytime anyone hangs up on you. I don't think.
Right. Well, you should pay attention to it though. And this
right,
is where it's the seed or it's nothing. Right. And so the way you control this is you find out if it's a seed or if it's nothing. Mm. Meaning you say, hey, can we talk about that you hung up on me? Like it's not okay. And what can we do differently? Like, how do we work this out? And you know, and then here's where people sort of get in trouble is they wait about 7 years of having significant problems in their relationship before they seek help.
But so you're saying
long.
You're saying that someone hanging up on you because they're angry or frustrated or whatever is enough of a sign to think to stop everything and say, dude, we need to talk about this. Or do that, we need to talk about
this. Yeah, this sounds extreme. I realize, and I'll tell you why. Because if that is now the new behavior, because the first time they did it, everyone just went, okay, it's fine. And then the next time they did it, it's like, well, they won't do it again. And I'm just talking about hanging up. But this is where it's the exact same thing when now he's hit me once. Well, he promises he'll never do it again.
That's the reason I'm asking you, because to me, a Luddite in that domain, it's obvious that now they've hit me once, but they won't do it again, is a clear sign. It's like we all know because of popular culture, it's been, you know, we've been bashed over the head with it so many times. We know this is not how it actually works. If they do it once, then, I mean, yeah, seek help. But hanging up seems so much more mundane. Going to, you know, stopping everything and saying we need to talk about it. Because if they don't want to talk about it, are you saying you should cut off the relationship, stop the relationship over one person hanging up?
No, I'm not saying that. But I am saying the psychology that applies when someone is hitting you. And I mean, there's every single woman on earth will say this out loud. I would never stay with someone who hit me. Mm. Never.
And yet.
So then why do the vast majority stay with someone who hits them? It's not because they're liars. It's because it took a million steps to get to the moment where he hit her. Mm. And those millions of steps are hanging up on me, walking out of the restaurant, throwing a fit, yelling at me, giving direct, I mean, there's so much that goes to that moment. So by then it's nearly impossible to walk away. Mm-hmm. And the need for it to get better is so strong. And again, you got to remember there's other things happening too. There's maybe, you're now isolated, right? He or she, most of the time it's he to she, but it can go both ways. Absolutely. Is that you're isolated from family and friends and those people who would help you, you know, and maybe they're helping trying in certain ways that are, and we can get into that. That isn't helpful. And so you are alone. So who do you need? Oh, you need this person. And this person's told you you're so crappy and that you're not worth anything and no one will love you. And you believed it because the thing has been built already. So let's go back to the hanging up on the phone. That's just impulsive and childish and grow up and figure out how to have some communication skills. Okay. It's not that big a deal, but what is powerful and preventative is you have not shown respect to the person you love, right? And so to address it, right? Maybe you have a trigger finger with hanging up and you've been doing it for your lifetime. You hung up on your mom and you hung up on your siblings and you have a bad habit. So you're now in a relationship and you're frustrated and upset and you don't want to keep talking. You get flooded. So you hang up. So your partner, if your partner just goes, well, I guess that's who he is, eventually it's eroding the respect that should be there. So by addressing it and just saying, can we talk about this? And let's not let 7 years go by where respect the lack of respect builds and builds and builds, is important. Now, most people don't know they should do this or could do this. They just have this, like, I'm just, like you were saying with that quote from the book or the movie, is, I deserve that. I did say that. Or, you know, that's that kind of game that starts to happen in your head.
Like, you rationalize, it's like, well, I was being this or that, and so I understand why they hung up on me.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm. Yeah. And I'm hard to live with. And you start to beat yourself up. And you know what? It justifies their behavior. And they're like, yeah, you are hard to live with. And that's where the tango really starts to begin, is you're sort of trapped in that. So I'm going to just read you some, just 20 things that this is what psychological abuse looks like. And then I'll leave what this looks like. And then we're going to talk about the person receiving it and what to do there. Mm. So, and you can stop me as I'm reading, but these are forms of psychological abuse, that I think sometimes people think some are just kind of normal, or he's just had a bad day. So just, you know, hear it for what it actually is. So number one, humiliating or embarrassing you. And that may start in small ways and that grows more.
Any level of embarrassing or humiliating someone, even meant as a joke, is part of that dynamic we were talking about with the bosses earlier. Okay.
Yes. And humiliating or embarrassing the person, like, they're your target. Your partner is your target, not I wore ugly socks and that embarrassed you. You know what I mean? Like, it's actively like finding a little bit of joy in making your partner feel bad. Mm. Right. So it has that element to it, not accidental or, you know, I didn't mean to do that kind of thing. And then another one, number two, constant put downs. So it's the backhanded, passive aggressive kinds of compliments sometimes are those, or just, you don't look good, or why are you wearing that? Just often it's a comment about physical appearance, intellect, you're just not that smart, that type of thing. Mm. And you think about that. Why would you be in a partnership with anyone who would say those things to you? And the answer is, it doesn't start like that, right? Mm. It starts with all of the amazing things, and then this comes eventually where you feel pretty garbage because they put you down.
I want to interrupt you for just a second and ask, maybe this is too simple a question, like I'm being a simple person now, but how guilty, because it sounds horrible that someone would do that, how, quote unquote, guilty is the person doing it? Are they a victim of their own abuses from their childhood, which just doesn't necessarily diminish the, you know, gravity of what they're doing at the moment, but, like, is it active nastiness, active evilness, or that's maybe a whole other episode, but...
No, that's a great question, and nobody thinks they're an abuser. This is
right.
What's
I guess
so
that's,
hard.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, kind of going back to the bubble of denial everybody lives in, right? So the abuser is feeling something. Now, often it can be from their own lack of self-confidence or self-worth. Maybe their childhood stuff is sort of showing up in this relationship. They feel vulnerable. You may have heard the term negging before, N-E-G-G-I-N-G. And it's a great word to describe this thing, which is it's an act of emotional manipulation where the person gives you this sort of passive aggressive or backhanded compliment that would normally supposed to feel good, right? Mm. But it undermines the other person and their confidence. And now they need you to approve of them again. Mm. So you're literally creating a place. And this is how the abuser maybe doesn't know they're going down this road, is they're getting what they want by doing this. They're getting a little more attention. They're getting that feeling of power. They're getting that they're wanted or needed or important. And this is the technique they're using to get it. Maybe they don't know it's all wrong, but they are getting rewarded for it. Some do. Some know they're being manipulative. Absolutely. But there's a lot of people who just have learned to be manipulative because they grew up in the home they grew up in or the schools they went to, or that's how you get ahead in the world. And they just are doing those things and maybe not recognizing that it's actually abusive. So there's other things. I'm just going to sort of summarize, but just refusing to communicate, sort of that cold shoulder ignoring kind of thing, is a powerful psychological abuse. being provocative with members of the opposite sex, using sarcasm, jealousy, like we talked about, extreme moodiness, mean jokes, they make fun of you, things like, I love you, but, you know, those kinds of things, withdrawal of affection, lots of guilt, guilt trips, isolating you from family, using money to control the other person is a pretty common one, controlling the bank accounts or how the money is spent, and constantly calling or texting when you're not with him. That's another one. And this is a whole nother episode, but just, you know, types of attachment. There's three kind of main types of attachment we talk about: anxious, avoidant, and secure attachment. And when a couple is healthy and in a secure attachment, they aren't afraid the other person's leaving them, or they don't ignore the other person. And those attachment styles often get sort of created as a young person. And so that's a fun area of research. If you're wondering, like, I wonder why my relationships are always like this, go Google attachment styles in relationships. You'll be amazed. Okay, so that's a lot of the behavior of an abuser, at least the psychological abuser. And then we get into the violent abusers, and, you know, that's a whole nother ball game of control and threat and, you know, punishment.
Yeah, I think this yeah, we can maybe skip that part. I'm really interested in hearing what people who are in those relationships can do, and maybe selfishly what people who are not and who witness them, as we were talking about earlier, can do to help.
Yes. Okay. So let's first talk. And if, again, another trigger warning, but these are the common responses that people who are being abused feel. So sometimes it's like, well, he does this and this and this, but, you know, that's hard to, always be aware of, because we can rationalize it away, or there's an excuse, well, he's had a rough day, or, you know, whatever. But if you check in with how you actually experience the world as a victim, potentially as a victim, that helps. So here's a couple questions to ask yourselves. Do you feel as if you are on an emotional roller coaster in your relationship? Is your partner loving and tender one minute and explosive the next? So that is a big sign where you feel like it's just sort of up and down. Here's another one. Do you know, in quote, know what you have to do to keep your partner from hurting your feelings? So if you think about that, that is, do you know how to behave in such a way to try to keep him or her cool and happy and not being mean to you?
Yeah, that if the answer is no there, it feels, and again, I have been in relationships where I think it wasn't so far from this. If you don't know how to act to be like to keep them from being abusive, or to feel that's weird. That shouldn't be like that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then here's another one. Do you end up pushing his or her buttons anyway because of something very small you forgot to pay attention to? So, you know your wife's big button you could push, and that would be a conscious, like, but this is, you've covered every base, you're so careful, but maybe you forgot to, you know, shut a drawer, and now that's a button hit that's pushed. So if you know that you have to memorize all the things to keep that person happy, that's a really big sign. Another one is, do you miss your friends and family? Are you spending less time with them than you have in the past? That is a textbook quality of an abusive relationship. You are more and more isolated from the people who would be concerned about you and care about you. Another one is, do you feel unfaithful or guilty and you're not sure why? And that's typically that jealousy piece, right? So if the abuser is, jealousy is their, one of their main feelings, they will accuse you of all the things and you will feel guilty and like you're bad and you've done something wrong, but you're confused because you didn't actually do anything. Another one is, do you smile more when you are around your partner in order to keep the peace? So pretend it's okay kind of thing. Are you nervous to bring friends or family into your relationship? You don't want anyone to meet them. Do you feel like you're not capable of making good decisions? Do you feel unworthy, and do you feel trapped? So if those things are happening,
if some of those things are happening, not all of them.
Not all of them, but they're very connected, most of them, right? And if you feel the beginnings of these things, like if we're catching anybody at the beginning of this development, it's crucial that you stop and seek someone's help to help you, whether it's a professional or talk to someone you've known a long time and trust and care about what they think about what's going on, you know, before you go further down the road. Because this is, it's like truly a roller coaster. Once you're on, it doesn't stop very easily. So that it's crucial if you're feeling any of this and before it gets any further, because typically the person, your partner, doesn't think they're abusive. They may need help just knowing how to communicate, knowing what to do with their shame or their pain from another part of their life that they're taking out on you, right? Nobody is ultimately all bad. And no one's all victim to some extent, right? We all are playing these different roles, but eventually those roles get really warped and you turn into the abuser and the victim. So earlier intervention, the better.
So, you did say it, but I want to make sure. So you say talk to someone, which is something, again, we hear all the time. Maybe some people aren't comfortable or don't have access to a mental health professional. Just even talking to a friend whom you trust and saying, so this is what happens and this is how I feel. What do you think? Like, is this normal? Is the thing to do.
It's the thing to do. And if you feel like there's no one you dare say that to, even though you have loving friends and family, then you're already in a problematic relationship. It means you're already scared to talk. So in those cases, or even if maybe you don't have a close friend you're ready to share this with, the internet is a powerful place for good and evil, right? But there is a lot of resources available to you. So I would recommend spending some time reading about it. There is some great books out there. In fact, there's one, it's on the top of my head and I'm forgetting it, is Why Does He Act This Way, I think, or Why Is He This Way? I'll look it up before we go or give it to you later for the notes. But some great ways to understand more about this. So what
why
doing
does he do pop, that?
Popping the bubble.
Why does he do that? Is that the Why Does He Do That? Is that the title of the book?
I'd have to Google it really quick.
Inside the Minds of Angry and Controlling Men.
Yes, that's it. Why Does He Do That?
Thank you. All right.
It just sounded so easy when you said it. Like, that can't be right. So what is it? And that one is great, of course, if the man is the problem in the relationship. But this idea of getting yourself self-educated initially is really important, because what it does is popping the bubble of, and the cycle of, oh, I'll just do this and I'm not, and isolated and I'm alone. I'm the only one. It's my fault. I'm the bad one. And that's part of that power, right? You're not alone. This has happened a million times. It will happen a million times more. There are so many other people who've been through these things, and there are so many resources. There's plenty of men and women who've been through these things that have written blogs, written books. So to start with educating yourself, if there's no other option besides Googling, then start with Googling and find out, you know, and here's where it gets tricky is that, let's say it's serious and it's destroying you, because ultimately it does. And that's the thing we know. These relationships don't just get fixed on their own. They don't just magically get better. Maybe someone's been hit on the head and they change their personality or something, but rarely is this ever ends without it almost destroying the victim psychologically, especially, right? Or it can end in death and a crime. I mean, there's obviously very severe places where this ends, or the victim just diminishing completely. And so there's no good end to this besides getting help. And often that includes leaving and then getting help. And so you say, okay, we're talking about the severe cases, right? You're not going to interrupt your brother and sister-in-law, whether arguing over a dinner, to say, you guys are abusive. And, you know, I don't think you're going to probably jump in right there. But this is where, when you have a friend who is, it's clear this relationship is not healthy for them. They may have even given you some ideas of like, I maybe not okay, or it's not okay. And I'm going to ask you first, Patrick, what is your initial thought of what to do? Let's pick somebody in your life. You can make them up. and they're in this kind of relationship, what is your first sort of gut response?
Yeah, I think obviously, as I said, I'm a little bit older now, but a few years ago, it would have been to tell them to stop or leave. And try to, it's funny, in a Phileas Club related way, to show them the facts of the negativity of their relationship. Because obviously, when they know the facts, when they know the truth and the reality of the situation, they will come to the logical conclusion and make the right decision, right?
Yeah. Because logic got them into this.
Obviously.
No. And so you are describing pretty much all of us, right? That, and I mean, I do this for a living and I still have to just smash that part of me that wants to go, okay, I'm going to go pick you up in my car and fly you somewhere and hide you. And that, you know, like it, that rescue and telling him what to do is our two biggest urges, to rescue and tell him what to do. And here's why, and I want everyone to memorize this. When you do that, you are just one more person controlling them. And that's, whether that's your intent, doesn't matter. That is how it feels. It feels like additional abuse and additional control. The reason is because you're telling them, in so many words, they are not trust. They can't be trusted with their own decisions, their own. I mean, you're just repeating it. What? That they're not smart enough. They don't know what to do. They have no power. I know what's best for you. Of course, you don't mean that, but that's what's coming across, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a couple things we can do. You got to fight that urge, number one. And then, well, first of all, if you do that urge, they will avoid you. That you will become the enemy, right? And they will just go further and further towards their partner, and because there's no one else, right? So you will have the exact opposite thing you want to have happen. So a couple things to think about. Number one is, and you got to maybe work through this before you sit down and talk to them about withholding all judgment and being very, very gentle. So you're gentle, you're not judging, and you're listening and you believe them, right? So sometimes we want, and maybe Patrick, for you, it's very analytical, right? Like they're going to say, well, he did it. And you're just like, what? No, you know, you could just find yourself going, this is an intellectual discussion. When really it's, you're talking to a very wounded, small animal, right? And logic doesn't help, you know, none of those things help, but sort of
I think one of the issues is that, again, tell me if I'm wrong, but I feel like the person you're talking to when they're telling you that seems okay. I think if they were coming to you looking like what you're describing, looking like a small wounded animal telling you, you know, this is what, you would be like, oh my God, are you okay? Like, but they're talking to you, they seem normal and like, what? Right. What are you talking about? This is unacceptable. You should do this and that. Like it.
Right. Yeah. They just, maybe their eyes are dead and everything else looks fine. And you're like, okay, something is going on. Yeah. What do I, you're exactly right. That's what makes it difficult. But here is where, when they do give you information and you are, you know, it's the question you just asked, which is, are you okay? And then listen and believe them. So here's some just stock things to say that are, and you'll notice a theme here. It's, I'm sorry this is happening to you. I know it's complicated. It's not your fault. You don't deserve this. This doesn't change how I feel about you. So you just give them that you get that this is so hard and complicated. You might really think this is easy, get away from him. But it is not, it is complicated. So if you are empathizing with the part of them that is really torn and reminding them, it doesn't change how you feel about them knowing this. You love them just the same. You are actually doing the opposite of control. You are reinforcing their autonomy and that you care about them and that that it's complicated. You're really just saying, like, you're actually smart enough. This is complicated. I'm sorry it's happening to you. Because when it's unsolicited intervention, it just comes across as disrespectful and controlling. And they're going to then have to decide to take action. I mean, they have to decide to take action, to leave, to get help. No one's going to do it for them. And you might believe you can, but especially if it's another adult. Obviously, if this is like a 17-year-old daughter of yours, there's you have a little more power, but you can still make those same mistakes.
So go ahead. If you ask them, you think, you know, it's not you think, it's obviously they're in a weird relationship, not okay, and you think they're not doing well, and you ask them, hey, are you okay? And they tell you, yes, it's fine. Then you have to wait until they can tell you that they're not okay or open the door. You can't force your, right, okay.
Unless you ask a couple more emotional questions, you might open that door anyway, right? Mm. I can't not do that. So I don't know what normal people do in a conversation. What I would be doing would be saying like, you know, you seem tired or, you know, like, you know, kind of just empathizing with.
Mm. And then maybe rough, it turns into
worried about you. Yeah.
Then it turns into, yeah, you know, actually I am tired and there's this, and it might lead to them opening up a little bit. Yeah.
Mm. And I think most of us have a tendency. I have the opposite tendency because of many hours of doing this, where I feel the pain and I move towards it. Mm. And most of us, we're at a coffee shop with a buddy and we sense their pain and we're going,
Did you see the last DC movie?
Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah. So how do I run from that pain as quickly as possible? In these kinds of situations, it'll just make them feel more abandoned and left alone. So be careful that you're not prodding and then running away, right?
Right.
But that you are really going to listen. So here's a way to say, because you know they need to probably get help and they probably maybe even need medical attention. And so you're going to want to tell them to do that. You have to do this. And we do that out of all of our mother instincts, right? And all of our be careful and be safe instincts. And those are good instincts, but they backfire here. So it might look like, are you open to getting medical attention or calling a hotline or going to the police or talking to an attorney? Like, are you, you're asking a question rather than telling them what to do, asking them if they're open to that.
Mm.
And then they may say no, or they may say maybe, but I don't know what to do. You know, so you're
putting it to them,
prodding them. Yeah, prodding them with questions and listening, right? Mm. And here's the thing. You can offer all the help you want, but they have to choose it. The only time in every country, and all the listeners are going to have different numbers to call and reasons, you know, resources for this, but you don't just offer and say, well, I guess you don't want my help if you are witnessing the violence. That is when you need to call immediately. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like say you're out together and, you know, she starts hitting him over the head with something. Mm. Call the police. Call, you know. But when you're asking for help, so that's an exception there. But if you're asking them what you can do, right? Because don't you always feel that, like, what can I do? What can I do for you? They don't know what to say.
Mm.
What are they going to say? Come and tell them to be nice? I mean, they don't know how to answer your question.
Uh-huh.
So instead of saying, like, you know, what can I do? Say something like, you're not alone. People care about you and I want to help. Do you want me to identify resources, go with you, watch your kids? You know, you got to think of some ways and they will then hear the thing that will probably help them and that they're willing to have you do. But if you just say, well, let me know if you need anything, they're going to go.
And am I correct in thinking that it might take a little while before it gets through? Like you say it and then they're like, it's fine. Like, oh no, it's okay. It's nice. But then a few days, a few weeks later, it percolates and it gets through and they're like, you know what? Actually, maybe this or that. Is that?
Yes, absolutely. And here's where this is how you practically do that is it's very important to check on your friend frequently.
Mm.
Months going by and not chatting with someone you know is in a really abusive relationship means lots can happen and no one will know. And so it's just that you're being a friend and you're sending texts and calling and emails, but be careful because often those partners are monitoring their behavior.
Mm.
So ask things like, is it a good time to talk? And they are protecting themselves all the time. They will find a good place, a safe place to talk. When they're ready to talk, but you be the one that's reaching out because they're spending all their mental energy surviving this. Mm. And also you do not want to, if best you can, to make yourself the enemy because the abuser will then banish you out of everything and or target you. So you've got to be careful there.
Okay.
And then I have one last one. I'll tell you real quick. The last thing is to plant the seeds of change by sort of gently telling them that help and guidance is available. So if you're yelling at them to get a lawyer and go to the doctor and call their therapist, you know, they're not going to hear that so much as the empathy that comes with this happens to a lot of people. Help is available when you're ready. It's, you know, when you're ready, I'll be with you. Here's there's a phone number, at least in the United States, for a national domestic violence hotline. And you can call that number. You know, there are shelters for you to go to. I mean, you're like a resource and you're doing it gently without telling them what to do, but that there's all this and you're not alone. This has happened before. There's lots of help available.
Is there, okay. So this is a really difficult question and we're going to end of this, but on this, but, is there a point or a moment where you've tried all you can and you've said, I'm available and you know what, you know, I can do this or that, or have you thought about maybe talking to someone? Do you think you would like to, or, and they're like, no, and stop annoying me. And they just don't want to accept the help. Is there a point at which you're like, I can't do anything and they have to come to me? And so, like, saying it harshly, is there a point where it's okay to give up for the time being, maybe? But
right. And maybe that you back it up and you're more of playing the friend role and you're still available. And that type of thing is probably the best thing you can do, because then they know where you are when they are ready. Don't underestimate the one voice in their life that says you're safe over here if you ever need anything, because there will come a night where he's choking her or slapping her or, you know, someone's chasing them down with, I mean, there's always another dramatic level that it will go to. And so giving up is not the right idea, more of backing up and being available. But again, like all people, you're human and you're feeling their pain and it's distressing to you and this is scary. So you need to make sure you're okay too. You're not the savior of the world. You're not going to fix this. You're not, you know, you are a friend trying to do the right thing. So to be careful for your own sake as well, that it doesn't become, now you're in a toxic relationship dynamic with this person because you're trying to rescue them. Now, and everyone has different ethical sort of guidelines. I personally, if I know of there of any violence and abuse going, I have as my licensure and, you know, the ethics of my profession, I call a hotline. I call my social work association board. I call the police. I don't have a choice. I just call.
When you know for a fact that there is physical violence.
Yes. And here's the thing. Every country is going to be different with how they investigate these types of things. Mm. But what happens if this is a good friend of mine, I have a lot more tools to help them prior to having to do this. But let's say I see my neighbors outside punching themselves, each other in the face. I'm going to call the police. The police are going to come. Maybe my neighbors will never talk to me again. That's high likelihood, right? And so that's part of that challenge of what line do you finally draw to ask for help to come in that's outside of you. And so everyone has to sort of decide where their line is. In fact, my line is just easy. I ethically don't have a choice. And so I don't have to spend any energy deciding. And I think most people do have to spend that time going, what do I do? How do I help? What, you know? And so this can be very taxing. So make sure you have support, make sure you're reading up on things, make sure you're okay. And knowing where your limits are, in being the helper, because this is tricky, and this is why it's so private and silent, and it crosses every single boundary in humanity. This doesn't happen more or less with poor or rich people. It doesn't happen more or less depending on your country, race, whatever. Like higher stress situations, maybe there's more occurrences of this type of thing, but it can be everywhere, and it's very much hidden, as we know, and so. It's tricky.
Well, that was a happy hour. I mean, I do feel like you're talking about the ultimate result of all of this is physical violence. From my experience, I've never, I guess, really seen that, not much, but there's still distress, which all of this can be super useful in addressing. Yeah. And that is also real harm being done. Yes. And the feeling of being trapped is so true.
Yes. And the harm being done, the victim, it takes a long time to sort of get back to a healthy place about your own self, right? And then let alone in another relationship. And so the earlier intervention, the better. And, that's just, yeah. I think goes without saying.
Well, what I have learned today is that my wife is so much more clever than I am, because she knows a lot about what you talked about. And my instincts are always to do the instinctual thing, but she tells me, no way. All right. Well, thank you very much. That was super interesting. I hope that the people listening got something out of it. Even if you don't know anyone who's in that kind of relationship, at least you understand these kinds of things a little bit more. Wendy, where can people find more of what you do online?
Yes. So therapythursdays.com, but I am terrible at that. But I have started a new thing with a friend of mine. She's a athlete and a nutritionist, and we are doing it's like a health challenge, but it's not like what you think of when you think of like lose weight and work out every day. It's more like real. And so it's at realsteps.org, and you can read about it, sign up if you're interested. And it's a month long thing, and how it works is everybody pays $50, and then we pick 2 to 4 people where we do so everyone is subsidizing these 2 to 4 people who will get full therapy, full nutritional counseling. And then the rest of the group does all sorts. They get all the same stuff, just not the individual treatment. So anyway, we've done one round. It was a blast. And we're going to do another one. So go to realsteps.org. That's a great place to find me. Or you can email me there, as well as Therapy Thursdays, if you have any questions. And that's where I'm at.
Perfect. Thank you very much. I will include the link to this in the show notes.
Awesome.
And for me, it's not Patrick, one word on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Instagram in particular, I'm using a little bit more these days. And if you want to support the show, you can do so at patreon.com/thefeedersclub. The link is in the show notes. It's an easy way and very quick way to support what I do. And if you enjoy the show, if you get something out of it, please maybe consider signing up. Thank you very much to all of those who already do. Thank you again to Wendy, and we will talk to you in about a couple of weeks for a regular episode with people from around the world. Bye.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.